Hey everybody, thanks for listening to this episode of My First Sketch at MyFirstSketch.com. I'm Josh Hyam. Any questions, thoughts, recommendations, feel free to email me at josh@myfirstsketch.com. You can like the podcast on Facebook at facebook.com/myfirstsketch. And it'd be really cool if you rate 5 stars and leave a review on whatever platform you choose. All right, I'll start out with the good stuff. Sketchybator, our sketch comedy open mic, live and in person, returns to Tattooed Mom on this Sunday, May 7th at 2 p.m. in the afternoon. All the information, including if you want to sign up beforehand, is available at sketchybator.com. All right, so something happened with the last episode of the podcast. I'm not sure how or why, but the RSS feed did not syndicate episode 196 with Rachel Nicewander out like it's supposed to. It was up on the website and on SoundCloud, but if you listen on another podcast or music app, it didn't show up until Sunday morning. All my searching for troubleshooting didn't yield anything too helpful, so with that, I'm looking into switching my hosting program. If you have any recommendations based on your own personal experiences, feel free to email me. For now, I'm going to host the episodes on SoundCloud and Spotify, and hopefully the RSS issues won't come up again anytime soon. Hopefully Spotify sends stuff out correctly. Sorry to Rachel that her episode didn't go out as widely as it should have, when it should have. But you can still go back and check it out before Rails Comedy plays Montreal Sketchfest on May 10th. Speaking of Montreal Sketchfest, it begins this Thursday night, May 4th, and runs through May 13th. So many friends of the podcast are performing, like Cam Wiley, Cheap Wine, Mom's Girls, Amanda Zeller, Bring Your Own Juice, John Hudson, Rails Comedy, The Tita Collective, Anesti Denellis, Erica Gellert, Unstoppable Failure, Joy Provision, and then so many others I haven't talked to yet. You can find out all the details at MontrealSketchFest.com. Today's guest is Vivek Srikanthan, currently a member of Triracial, based out of Toronto, Ontario. Viv and the rest of Triracial are heading to Montreal Sketchfest performing Friday, May 5th in the 10 p.m. slot at the Montreal Improv, along with Sproink and Oink from Montreal and Cheap Wine from Toronto. Tickets and more information are available at MontrealSketchFest.com. Viv's first sketch is called Escape Room. Viv reads the roles of Liz and the Rooms Master, and I read John and give all the stage direction. So let's get to the sketch. Lights up. Liz and John standing around center stage looking around. And then I says to Mabel, I says, the Room Master enters.
Hello and welcome to Through the Looking Glass Escape Room Adventures. You are now in one of our finest rooms. Sir, there's actually not much here but a single chair and a bucket. But our escape rooms are designed to function and replicate one of our many scenarios that you'll be reenacting as you attempt to escape from our room.
And what scenario is this?
Imagine, if you will, you are a couple of lovers. Journalist, perhaps, is your occupation, and your marriage is unfortunately on the rocks. On a trip to a Middle Eastern dictatorship to write about, I don't know, whatever hardships they got going on there, you suddenly get kidnapped by a group of rebels, and you wake up here. And so, you must find your way out.
Find our way out? What? This is a goddamn torture room. There's a chair, a bucket. There's a fake skeleton in the corner, jumper cables?
Yeah, fake. Sorry, what? And your time begins now. As always, there's a surveillance camera where I can watch your every move, and if you need any help, just wave. Goodbye.
The Brewmaster leaves? Okay, all right, so Liz walks to the corner of the stage.
Babe, I don't think this is a fake.
Liz, will you pay attention? The clock is running.
Okay, maybe I'm supposed to sit in the chair.
Liz sits in the chair, then heavy metal music starts blaring. Okay, good. I don't know why they're playing heavy metal music. I feel like this is a scene out of Zero Dark Thirty and not from the Middle East. The Room Master enters covered in some sort of Middle Eastern garb. All of a sudden, he puts a bag over Liz's head and starts shouting at John in a different language violently and pointing at her.
Hey, what the hell?
Sir, I don't know what I'm supposed to do here. The Room Master points to the bucket. Oh, hell yeah. I see where this is going.
John, I swear to God, if you waterboard me, I'm going to cut your...
The Room Master yells at Liz. John goes with the bucket to the corner and then picks up some of the water. So, babe, I don't know how this is going to go down. Just know I love you.
You dirty rat.
John Waterboards Liz. You know what? This is actually kind of fun. Tell me who you're working for, you drunken spy. The roommaster and John look at each other and share a hearty laugh that then gets awkward. The roommaster takes the bag off Liz.
You fucking bastard. What the hell's wrong with you?
The roommaster goes and gets the jumper cables and hands them to John.
Oh, no. If you do that to me, John, I swear to God, we're...
John puts the bag on Liz's mask. Ah, shut up, you. John puts jumper cables on her and the roommaster pulls a switch. Liz is getting electrocuted. Tell us what we want to know. Give us the information.
Okay. I slept with Brian.
The roommaster stops. You did what?
It was one time. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. It was a terrible mistake. We had a fight, you know, and I went to see some friends. He texted me. Oh, God. Babe, I'm so sorry.
John is flabbergasted. The roommaster takes the bag off Liz's head and John starts crying.
Holy fuck. That was some real shit. I just gotta say what I did back there. That was for entertainment. You know, that was for immersion. But what you did, Jesus Christ, you're a despicable human being. What is wrong with you? You are a terrible, sad little being and you have my pity.
The roommaster abruptly leaves. John continues crying and Liz just stands there. Liz slowly, sneakily walks away. John continues to cry for quite a long beat and then lights down.
My name is Samantha Russell. I'm a sketch comedian, and I have a prop and costume hoarding problem. So I figured the best way to get it under control is to start a podcast. On Should I Keep This? I chat with other comedians about their experiences in comedy and our insane prop and costume collections. And on each episode, we both bring a beloved item to discuss whether it's a treasure or just trash. Sometimes it turns out no matter how much money or time we spent on a prop, the only thing we should be holding on to are the memories we've made along the way. So check out Should I Keep This? We have new episodes every 2 weeks available anywhere you get your podcasts.
Hey, Viv.
Josh, good to be here.
Tell me about the sketch. Tell me about this escape room. Where did this idea come from?
I don't know. I feel like four to 5 years ago, you know, before the pandemic, like escape rooms were starting to be a little bit bigger. And then I actually went to one with my writing pals in the Second City Training Center, like our class. So I went with a bunch of people and be like, you know what? Like, I haven't really seen like an escape room sketch, although I'm sure there've been, you know, many of them. I just never saw one. So, you know what? I'll just try an escape room. It seems like a good scenario, good opportunity for beats, you know, for story and just, you know, room for funny.
Yeah. So, and you went with like comedy friends. What, like,
yeah.
Was it almost like you were already acting out the bits as you did it, or were you actually just full-on serious about doing the escape room and enjoying the experience?
From what I remember, we were kind of just like full sending it, you know? But I think one of the big things was I didn't know, you know, that was my first escape room experience. And there's like a guy, or, you know, could be a woman, a person that's just kind of like giving you like a story of like the room you're in. And I'm just like, I don't care. You know, like I just want to solve the puzzle. I want to get mine and get out of here and be like, yeah, you know, we did that. You know, no room can contain me. But like the fact that there was like a person telling a story definitely kind of kickstarted that premise, I'd say, for me, where it's like, oh, okay, like, and this can be anything, you know, you can, it's like, it's a shitty room, you know, not the one we went to, but it could be a shitty room and be like, oh no, you're in a vast magical world. You know, it's just like, all right, buddy, just get us in the room and lock the door.
I've never done an escape room because I think they, you know, got popular right before the, you know, and I just never did them. But like, I was thinking about, I'm like, they're basically just like four pieces of like sheetrock with decorations. Like they're so haphazardly quickly made into whatever mall or like strip mall that they are. Like you have to like give them a little extra like story to forget that they're just little stores and malls now. Like that's it.
Yeah. It's definitely like the one I went to was like, it was just like, you know, it was like a plaza in some small like neighborhood. I'm just like, and it's just like, you know, they got like four rooms and then it's like, oh, you know, there's a There's a ladder, there's a safe, there's, you know, just like the bare minimum in terms of like set dressing. So it's like, all right, well, I guess that's what you need. You know, you got to like ramp up the story in your head, and, you know, and it is fun though, even however kind of shitty it might look, but it is a lot of fun just kind of solving mysteries, you know, with your buddies and escaping out the door. And you get to hold like a little sign, you know, that says I beat it.
Or you get the sign that you didn't beat it, that you lost.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I wouldn't know about that. I'm a winner.
Which, why would you even take the picture and like publicize it if you did lose?
I know, right? Yeah. No way I would be telling people, I don't know puzzles. I'm sorry.
That 24-piece jigsaw puzzle really screwed me over. So you mentioned that you went with people that you knew from the Second City Training Center. So I'm assuming that's where your sketch writing world starts. So tell me about your decision to start doing Second City.
It's actually kind of long-winded the way I went around there, because initially I started the improv program at Second City, and I did three classes, and then I just very much just kind of like dropped it. And I don't know, I'm not really sure looking back why I dropped it. Like, it was definitely a lot of fun, but I've always considered myself like wanting to be a writer, you know, and, mm-hmm. and you know, although I find performance very easy, like it's weird. I find acting like a sketch on stage, like that does nothing, like that does, I don't get any of the heebie-jeebies or anything like that. Like, that comes very naturally to me. But like, I was really interested in like writing, and I took a bunch of other Second City courses. Like, they have like a pilot script writing course, and you know, all that. I did stand up for a little bit, and then, you know, like 2 years later, I was like, you know what? I'll just try the sketch writing program. And then, fortunately for us, that like our group was just so kind of, we weren't like close knit, but everyone had a good time after the first level, and then we were just like, you guys want to just like keep going? And we're like, yeah. And then, you know, at I don't know if it's still like that before, but when you get to like the fifth and sixth level, you actually, for us, you put on like a weekly show, like every Saturday. And like, you know, you're writing like 30 to 40 minutes of material with people and like putting that on. And it'd be like seven shows every term. So we put on 14 shows in like, you know, 3 to 4 months. And it was like a really good experience.
What were you into? Were you a comedy fan growing up? What made you laugh? Like,
yeah, I would definitely say like comedy's always been just kind of like the pipe dream, or, you know, still doing it now. But, you know, as a kid, like I was always a classic clown, and like probably two of the foremost influences for me was, you know, Jim Carrey, because, you know, I was born early 90s. So you'd be watching The Mask, Ace Ventura, Liar Liar, and just like, you know, just making faces, you know, doing wacky stuff. And then I have an older brother who's like 8 years older than me, and he also influenced me in terms of like, it's just easier to make friends when you're just kind of like a clowny kind of character, you know? So I'm like, oh, okay, yeah. That's why he's like, that's why everyone knows his name. So I'm gonna be doing that too, you know?
Okay, so you mentioned like Jim Carrey. Was he like the big like comedy influence growing up for you?
I'd say yeah, for probably like the first, you know, 10 years of my life, you know, just, you know, making faces, being loud, just, you know. And The Mask is probably like, you know, such a legendary movie for me, but it's just, he's just electric on screen. But, you know, there's also that kind of like, you're rooting for his kind of like, you know, his normal self along with his like wacky self, you know. And yeah, I was just, you know, this was before I even started watching SNL and, you know, sketch, you know, TV. And I was just like, this guy's just making me laugh. He's getting paid like millions of dollars. And it's like, okay, I want to do that, you know.
Yeah, getting paid millions of dollars to make people laugh is definitely sounds like a bonus on a bonus on a bonus.
Yeah, right.
All right. So what really drew you to taking, you know, you mentioned doing improv first. So what drew you to doing that class at Second City, like instead of going somewhere else within Toronto, or just, you know, doing stand-up or something?
It's, I don't know. It's weird because a lot, my circle of friends was, you know, I grew up in a low income kind of neighborhood, you know, public housing, things like that. So all my friends were just kind of like, you know, BIPOC people who were kind of going through the same situation. And, you know, we never really knew of any of that. And then at some point, one of my friends told me, it's like, you know, they have like classes for like, you know, being funny. And I'm like, really? And then that's when I first heard about the Second City. And you know, at that point I was kind of dead set on like writing because I was really influenced by The Simpsons and like just like, you know, getting paid to just kind of sit around and make jokes in a room sounded so exciting for me. And then that's what pushed me towards like, okay, so I'll decide to take a bunch of classes. And, you know, I have memories of, and improv was the first thing I took. And then I have memories of myself just kind of, you know, we didn't have cable, but, you know, with the antenna, you get a bunch of channels. And I remember watching Whose Line as a kid at like, you know, 10 p.m. and doing real old lady stuff. Like I take, I must have got this from like a TV show, but I used to take like a bucket of like water, fill it up in the bathtub with hot water, go to the couch with the bucket and sit down and soak my feet in it as I would watch Whose Line.
I mean, that's, you know, that's your self-care. It's fine. That's, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I think other people
self-care, put hell yeah.
other things in the bucket instead of just water. Like, I feel like there should be, like, some kind of, like, Epsom salt or something. But you were young. You didn't know that.
I did. You know, I definitely saw it in, like, a TV show. And I'm like, oh, that looks like a fun time. I'm very much, easily gullible. And I'm just like, oh, that looks cool. You know, I'll just do that. All my heroes are, like, were fictional characters first instead of like the people kind of playing them. So, you know, I talk about Jim Carrey, but I was like, oh, the mask, like, I want to be like him. I want to be Homer, you know? Like, the, it was very much like that. Like, oh, these are characters that people love, right? And it wasn't necessarily that people playing them. It was just kind of like, oh, I want to be this like fictional character like Homer. He's kind of like a goofy, you know, dad, but he's a loving dad. He can get angry sometimes, but it's just like, but it, you know, it's a nice world he lives in. And, I don't know, that was me as a kid, you know, just kind of being like, oh, my role models are fiction versus like actual people.
Yeah. Real people tend to disappoint you more. So it's fictional characters might not.
90% of my heroes are cornballs now.
You do the improv, you take a couple of years and then you finally do the sketch team. And I mean, the sketch classes, and you say that group basically stays together. Do you go through the entire process? Like, do you go all the way through to the conservatory? Like, because I keep forgetting how the Second City is laid out, like class-wise.
Yeah, yeah. I think if you take all the improv courses, you know, I think it's like A through E, then that gets you kind of like a foot in the door to audition for the conservatory. But there's nothing like that for the writing. Okay. It's just kind of like you're learning how to write sketch. And fortunately for us, like, there was at the end of the program, like, you can produce your own show and like you get to write and act in it, you know? So I don't know if it's different now where it's like, you know, you can write a sketch show, but like people from the conservatory might be the ones to like you act to cast into the show, you know?
Right. Yeah, it was a
pretty cool experience, but a different one, right?
Yeah, I wasn't sure if I had forgotten whether the conservatory program was for improv or sketch. So, but it was interesting to hear that you had what I would call a show class, where the class was to write a show, like, because that was my first, because here in Philadelphia, like our little comedy theater down here, that was my first real experience. Was like, you know, I did a 101, and then they did a show class with Kevin Allison of the State as like the teacher, and apparently it wasn't selling very well. So, you know, the owner of the theater's like, hey guys, payment plans are if you want to do this. So like in like 24 hours, like another 8 people signed up to take this class. And that was my first experience. So like the idea of like having that class to put on the show first is definitely, I feel, way less daunting than like trying to do it all your own, you know, route one by yourself.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that's, I mentioned that I did stand up, and one of the things that like put me out of the stand-up game for a while, I've been thinking about going back into it, but just very, it's solo, right? You know, and if you don't have a buddy to do it with, it's just kind of like, okay, like, you know, going to an open mic where the open mic's probably like only the comedians in the audience are trying to memorize their own set, so they're not really paying attention to what you're doing. And, you know, or like, you know, I remember I have memories of just taking an hour, you know, bus and walking right to get to an open mic, and then it's like 5 people in the audience in this dank basement, and then and nobody's laughing at my jokes. Not that they were any good, probably, you know, but it's just kind of like, oh, man, this grind is like often. I really want to do something with people. You know what I mean?
Mm.
And luckily, so you know, that writing program had that.
So you definitely feel the whole collaborative side of comedy versus the solo side.
Yeah, yeah. That's not to say, you know, I might, you know, do some solo stuff, or, you know, like I said, I want to get back in stand-up, but like, definitely, like, I wouldn't have been able to do it alone. Knowing there was other people kind of in the muck with me, you know, who are also interested in this stuff, definitely was like, okay, you know, like, I can depend on people. And sketch, it's like, oh, if you fuck up on stage, it's like, well, there's five other people there to support me, you know, and tell me, oh, it's fine, it's fine.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully they pick you up. All right, so you mentioned doing this show with Second City. What's your next step? Like, what is your next opportunity to pursue sketch comedy after that?
You know, like, it's really just, you know, we learned how to produce a show, you know, like tech, you know, coming up with sketches, a set list and whatever. But then after that, it's just kind of like, all right, you're on your own, you know? So yeah. It's like, and, you know, we knew a couple of people, and then you figure out how to like produce shows, which is like, you know, we have a couple of really good like comedy theaters that are also kind of like intimate, kind of cheap to rent. And, you know, you put down like, hey, can I get an hour for like $75? And then you produce a couple of shows, and that's what we did. But the problem was, you know, it was 2019, like middle of that, when we, like summer 2019, when we started and exiting the writing program and starting to produce shows. And then we had like two shows, I want to say, in the start of 2020, and then things were looking on the up and up, and then you know what happened.
Yeah. So what was this this group called? Like, that you got out of the Second City program? Like, were you as together as a group? Like, what were you performing as?
We were billing ourselves as the Citizens of Mars.
Okay. Where does that come from? Like,
it's like improv troupe names, you know? It's just like, nobody really cares. It's just, let's just sound wacky. But it was just like one of those ones where like, well, like there's 50 names, and we're just like, that's the least worst, you know?
I always care, because like, I'm always curious about like, where'd you come up with this? Like, what is this, a reference to something? Like,
yeah. And I'm a big, like, my sketch titles, when I write sketch titles, I'm like, there has to be like at least a pun or some sort of thing going on in the title of my sketch. And everyone's just kind of like, why do you care? Like,
it's, even, yeah, because no one's ever going to see no one's ever going to see the title of your sketch. Like, yeah. It's, I don't know.
My way, you know, we'd announce every one of my sketches before we performed them.
We tiptoed around the pandemic. Like, you had just gotten your start about, you know, we'll say 6 to 9 months, the world stops. So what are you doing? Is this team staying together? Are you going to work together through it? Like, what happens during the pandemic times?
Absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
It was a miserable pandemic for me. We attempted a Zoom sketch show that went
awful.
But it's, you know, the Zoom shows are like,
yeah,
you know, it's hard to even, like, you don't even know if people laugh, because like, everyone's on mute, first of all, you know what I mean? And then there's also the delay in, you know, bouncing off dialogue and beats and whatnot, you know? And then it was a miserable kind of like first year. And then we ended up, so that's, that class is actually where I met John, you know, who I'm in with Triracial. We ended up developing with two other people, Taylor O'Leary, who was with us in the writing class, but then had to drop out. And Megan also, you know, had to drop out at some point. But we ended up creating this, developing this show called Schooling Around, which was a 90s sitcom sketch parody. And we were really excited about the prospect of that. And then even in the pandemic, you know, we decided, you know, we can't put this on stage, but let's just film a couple of videos. You know, let's get some online content out there. And that's where we ended up creating like a kind of like a short film, kind of proof of concept, and then it actually won a bunch of like filmed awards, which was actually kind of nice.
Very cool. So tell me about Schooling Around then. Like, was it just you and John creating this parody, or?
It was, I would say it was me, John, Megan, Taylor. We, you know, we developed this kind of like 90s sitcom sketch show, very influenced by like 90s Saturday morning kind of like television. Saved by the Bell, you know, and the story is basically kind of like, because it's a sitcom sketch parody, it's about a bunch of kids in high school, but you know, because of the parody of Saved by the Bell, you know, you have like laugh tracks, you know, and we're every sketch, we developed this show as kind of like a sitcom where you have three acts, but every scene in the show is like a sketch in and of itself. And every sketch is a parody of like some sort of like 90s thing, you know, like there's the sex sketch or like the, you know, the guidance counselor sketch or, you know, just a whole bunch of different kind of topics that we'd lampoon, you know, about like 90s Saturday morning television.
Were you able to pull in other people to like to fill out the cast for this, or was it just the four of you?
Yeah, it was actually quite a big cast. So we had like six main characters, three girls, three women, and we also had a puppet character that was that was our big X factor in the show, which was, and he's kind of like, I'm not sure if you know of like Ed the Sock, I'm sure, or you know, Triumph, you know,
yeah,
the Insult Dog or you know, comic, you know, and it's very much in that vein where he's like a guidance counselor, but he's, you know, all of it's bullshit, all of it's nonsense. He's just like a really terrible drug in, you know, induced smoking, you know, puppet.
So how, like, so you start filming things through the pandemic, like, and roughly timeline wise, when is this, like, are theaters open yet, or is this still like the dark ages of it?
So I'd say we started it about, you know, we start filming stuff around 2020, you know, and we're just kind of like, you know, obviously you still have to kind of socially distance and all that, and we were just kind of like, you know what, okay, so the guys of the overall framework of the show was that it was presented on this kind of like channel, so we're like, okay, why don't we, you know, make this quote-unquote like TV channel, and then we have commercial parodies along with the show, so you know, we'd lampoon, you know, Folgers coffee, or, you know, in Canada there's like a North American House Hippo kind of like, you know, PSA about, you know, don't believe everything you hear. And so we started filming those little kind of like bits and pieces, and then, you know, you can only do so much when, you know, it's still, you know, you're still under lockdown, you know, people are, we're all trying to be safe. And then I can't remember if it was 2020 or 2021, as we filmed our first kind of like proof of concept for the show, where it was like a 10 to 15 minute like episode, and that was our big thing. And and originally it started out as like a sketch thing, but we ended up turning it into like this webisode thing, and then we submitted to a bunch of film festivals, and it won a bunch of awards, and it was just like, oh shit, you know. And then lockdown comes out, or stops or whatever, and we were able to put on two kind of episodes of this kind of sketch show together. And after that, you know, it's hard to keep a large troupe together, you know what I mean, when people have other side hobbies.
Yes.
And, you know, gigs, or, you know, or they lose interest, you know, like when we were developing the show in the first part, when we had the webisode, you know, two of the people in that webisode were not there for either of the next two. And every episode, every show, we did two theatrical shows. Each one of those shows, we had to bring on three new people, like, every time, realistically.
I mean, on one hand, you know, as you say that, I'm thinking that the form that you've created here in that schooling around that parody of the 90s, you know, Saturday morning show, you have a built-in explanation for that. Like, because yeah, their shows had a lot of turnover, like...
Yeah, 100%. And we definitely kind of, you know,
Kelly and Jesse go?
Chick. Yeah, like, exactly. We'd make jokes like that, and it's all part of that experience. But again, like, you know, logistically trying to like get people to, you know, be a part of this thing, and, you know, and I, you know, the Toronto comedy scene is pretty big, but in terms of sketch, it's actually, I'd say, not as big as you'd think, in my opinion.
You're still pulling from the same 100 people that are doing other multiple things. So, like,
exactly. And, you know, we had, you know, one of our characters was an Asian, you know, woman. That was how we wrote it, you know. And we, you know, we'd have, you know, specific, you know, Asian, you know, jokes there, you know, like kind of calling attention to the fact that the 90s were just kind of like a weird time in terms of like what was politically correct and what it's now, you know, we're making that 90s to 2020 connection. And then, you know, the person we cast had to drop out, and then, so we had to rewrite the character at in our second show as, you know, be played by a white woman.
I mean, it's good that you rewrote it and not just kept going. Like,
would have been pretty funny, but yeah, definitely couldn't do that.
Like, one of the most uncomfortable things I've ever seen in theater or anything was, I mean, if you're familiar with the musical Avenue Q, there's a character that very much has to be Asian, an Asian woman. And I saw, like, a local production where she was not an Asian woman. And, like, it was as yellow face as you could be for a light-skinned Black woman to do. And I was just like, yeah. Oh, none of this feels good to me. Like, everything else about the show is fine. This was a bad idea. It's one of those things, like, if you can't cast that role correctly, don't do the show.
Yeah, or just, you know, kind of like finagle your way, rewrite it, you know, just like, you know, it's, we're not in that kind of climate anymore where it's like, you know, we can put on, you know, those faces, right?
Yeah.
I'm sure you could have done that way back when, but not now. And it's, you know, audiences have like kind of like leveled up in their kind of sense of culture and just kind of like what's funny and, you know, what's not funny anymore, right?
So even with all like the headaches of having to recast and rewrite things like that, how did it feel to get back on stage, like after that, you know, pandemic layoff?
Oh, it was amazing. Like I said, I was miserable because as like, you know, in terms of my creative output, you know, besides like writing, which I still want to do, it's hard to write. And it's also a very solitary thing, right? And I mentioned before how it's like, I enjoy like just kind of collaborating with people. Like that's always, it's not just like, you know, it's like, oh, I get help on, you know, it's creatively fulfilling, but it's also, I like hanging out with people. I like, you know, just seeing people and just like being social, you know? And then like getting back on the stage, it was just kind of like, you know, and we used all our friends and family calling cards to like pack that first show. It was like, it was amazing. It was just like, you know, we came out of the show. I can't even describe it. It's just kind of like, it's a high, right? It's like, you have a good show. It's just a high, you know? And now I live for the end of the show.
I hope that we all have that, like, that we all had that experience of that first show post-pandemic, post-lockdown, where like, whether you're performing or even just in the audience, that first live comedy show and like the euphoria, the super good feeling that it created. I hope everyone had that experience.
Yeah, I hope so. And, you know, I'm sure they did because, you know, their audiences were hungry to get back out there too, right? Like go out and do something, right? And the live comedy is a special thing. It's just, it's just a, you know, it's a communal experience, I feel like,
yeah.
You know?
So tell me about the evolution to triracial. How do we get triracial? Like, how do we get to the birth of triracial?
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to kind of just trying to logistically develop the school and around show where, you know, where we had dropouts, you know? So that's actually how we ended up getting Derek into our troupe was because, you know, one of our original kind of guys who was supposed to do a role, and his role was kind of like the, you know, the Mario Lopez, you know, just kind of like the jock, you know, guy.
Mm.
And then this is going to sound weird, but like John's girlfriend's sister was dating somebody and his friend was Derek. And Derek's like, he's a well-known stand-up comedian. And then John met Derek. John's like, hey, we got this role. We need to fill. Do you want in? And that was Derek's first ever kind of sketch thing. And he, you know, he killed it. You know, it was a great show. And then, you know, as we were trying to develop these other school and around shows, we just kind of wanted to get back to kind of like, you know, because it's a concept, right? Like the school and around, it's like, it's very niche thing. You know, it's highly conceptual. We just kind of want to get back to like basics with just doing random sketch comedy and just writing like, oh, this, I found this funny today, or if I have this premise, and just kind of like doing it, you know, instead of like, oh, well, so writing for school and around is very much like a writer's room, like you're writing a TV show kind of experience.
So how was the first show together as triracial? Like, how did that go?
It was good. Yeah, we had a couple of like, our first show ever was like a 5-minute set at this place called Sweet Action Theater. And they do kind of like weird clown comedy there. So it's really,
it was kind of a
weird thing to kind of like, oh, it's our first show. And like, we only went on the show because we saw a post where it's like, hey, you know, Dota Dome's looking for acts to, you know, get on and do 5 minutes. And like, hey, why don't we just kind of like put our feet in the water there? We did it. People liked us, but it was weird being like the only sketch group where other performers were doing kind of this very conceptual, surreal, just kind of like, and I'm sure you've heard of like clown comedy where it's like, you know, like it's just like out there, right? And then I almost felt weird coming out of it. I'm just like, oh man, like, are we dated? Like, is this what's going on in the community?
you're just on the wrong show. That was it. That was all. Like,
yeah. But people liked us, you know?
And, you didn't totally fit the theme.
We did well.
Good.
Yeah, but we did well. It was a good show. And then we tried to produce a couple of shows, you know, because really, honestly, if you want to start performing, like, seriously, you gotta start producing your own show, like, and find like a cheap theater or whatever. You know, SoCap is a great one in Toronto, and that's where we produced like a couple of shows where we were building a material. It's just kind of like a night for people in the sketch community to kind of like, hey, you know, do you guys have like 10 minutes, you want to try some new material, right? And then that's where we kind of built our set, you know. And sketch, like I said, it's not really, I wouldn't say it's potent. I would say even now, like, we haven't really produced that show in a while, but like, you know, there's only really like 2 to 3 shows, I'd say, you know, a month, you know, for sketch.
And I would say that, like, that sounds fantastic to me, because in Philadelphia, we are still rebuilding and figuring out what venues we have and who's still around. Because I've made this joke before, but like, during the pandemic, everyone either had a baby or moved to New Jersey. And
oh, geez,
like our original comedy scene, I don't know what, you know, who's still around anymore. So we're definitely rebuilding and restocking our pond with either new comedians or new venues. And so, two to three a month sounds great.
Yeah, I guess we can't complain too much, because like, it's Toronto, you know, like, people consider us like a world-class city, you know, like, should, there's definitely a scene here, you know. And, you know, it sounds bad in Philly. not very sunny in Philadelphia, apparently.
So how would you describe like the voice or the tone of a tri-racial show? Like, what would an audience expect from it?
Yeah, we're just asking them to, you know, tri-racial. I mean, the whole show is just kind of centered around, so it's me, Derek, and John. It's, you know, a brown guy, white guy, and a black guy. So, I mean, you know, a lot of our influences are like, you know, Chappelle's Show, you know, things like that, SNL, you know. Just we knew we had kind of like a weird kind of privilege to kind of like do racial stuff, because, you know, sometimes it's like hard to bring that stuff up in the, you know, in the comedy community, you know. It's like, it could if you do it wrong, it's gonna be bad, but if you do it well, like, people are on board, right? And that's, you know, it's challenging, but it's also, it's almost fun, you know, trying to straddle that line and, you know, see how our material fares with that kind of thing. And like I said, that's our POV. But one of the things we do is, I think, at least for our show, it's, you know, everyone gets their kind of comeuppance, you know, like, we're self-deprecating, I'd say. And that's what really makes us kind of pop, where it's like, you know, it's not just like, you know, it's not just, you know, white guys suck, you know, because that's the only thing you can say about race, because everyone's too afraid to kind of like do, you know, bit stereotype, because, you know, it could be bad, right? It could be hurtful, you know, you don't want to punch down. But I'd say one of the unique things about our show is, like, you know, you'll have sketches where it's like, I'm the character that's kind of like, you know, being a little weird, being a little stereotypical, but like, I get my comeuppance, or where, you know, I'm making fun of stuff from my heritage, you know, where, and I can say that because, you know, it's not, John's not writing the sketch, it's me, I'm writing the sketch, you know?
Yeah, like, I think, you know, I certainly couldn't write a lot of racial stuff. Like,
it's tough. It's, again, it's like, even where I feel like we're like making sure, hey, wait, let's not go over some boundaries. You know? But it's, yeah, it's, you know, it's definitely, it's nice to be able to kind of like do a sketch where I can say that I suck, you know, or like, you know, like I have this one sketch where, you know, I'm an immigrant, you know, and I'm trying to connect. I'm a recently landed immigrant. I'm trying to connect with people. So I see a white guy at a bus stop, and that's played by John, obviously. And I talk to him in a full on Canadian accent, you know, and then he leaves because I'm a weirdo. And then Derek comes in, and it's like, you know, he's black. So I talk to him in like a full on like black accent, you know, and then he's like, actually, I'm Italian. And then I talk to him in an Italian accent, you know, and then, you know, that's, you know, obviously I'm being like stereotypical and stuff, but like I kind of get my weird kind of comeuppance because, you know, in the POV of the story, it's like, I call my mom. It's just like, you know, it's hard to talk to people because I'm trying to talk to them in their language and their accent, but nobody wants to talk to me. And then the kicker is that, you know, they see me and then they're stereotypical to me. They're like, hey, look, it's a brown guy, you know, it's Apu. Thank you. Come again. And then I'm like, oh man, they're finally trying to talk to me, you know, and that's great, you know, and that's, you know, that's the way we're trying to like, okay, well, you know, if it just ended at like the, it's Apu, thank you, come, you know, that's awkward, right? But it's like, oh, if I understand that, and I know, like, that's, these are signs and symbols, you know? So it's sounding really pretentious, but like, you know, it's just kind of like everyone's just kind of like learning to, you know, not talk about race or stuff in the past the way they used to, and just kind of like elevate, you know? And that's what we're trying to do. At least I think so. Could be entirely wrong.
I mean, if you're trying to do it, like, great. But like, I just, that thank you, come again joke was so prevalent for me growing up in the 90s, you know, that whole Apu thing, where I think my brother did it once around the dinner table, and like all of his kids just like whip pan just stared at him like, what are you doing? Like,
yeah.
Don't you understand? And then that thing with the Simpsons and Apu, where Apu has, I don't know if he's not, I know he hasn't spoken on the show in the last couple of years. I don't know if he's been completely ran out.
Yeah.
Because I haven't been watching it.
I think it's very,
because that documentary that Hari Kondabolu made, which was great and like really eye-opening, like how we are rethinking all those characters. Like,
yeah.
Is there any like trepidation for you to walk into that kind of, like, as you mentioned in that joke, you do, in that sketch, you do kind of go that way?
Yeah, and it's like, you know, that's, it's almost, I wouldn't even say that's like me being, or, you know, me being kind of like, oh, you know, that's fine, you can say that stuff. And I don't hope that's like the message people get from that sketch. It's kind of like, listen, like I'm, as the writer, kind of like retaking ownership of that phrase and like turning that into kind of like a good thing in this story, because it's like, oh, like, you know, he, you know, they're trying to talk to him in the imaginary scenario of the story. And it's weird. I've definitely had like a weird thing about like race. Like when I first started writing sketch, I was like, you know, I thought it was a meritocracy. I thought the whole world was like, if you're good, you know, you'll get there. But no, I mean, it's really about networking and, you know, like who has the privilege of, you know, being, having a leg up. But I thought when I first started writing, I'm like, I don't want to write any race stuff because I want to be funny for the sake of being funny. And I never wanted to use POV. I never wanted to like talk about my own experiences. And then like, you know, the past like 5 years, everything took a turn where it's like, oh, now it's like, it's interesting to talk about like kind of like your heritage and things like that. And I'm like, oh, so maybe I should kind of investigate that, you know? But I was very much kind of subscribed to this world of like, no. Like, if you're funny, like, you're funny. And like, we'll know that. You know, it almost felt like it was cheating to kind of like write about race or write about my ethnicity or my family or anything, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting because like, I've never really thought about like my comedy writing in terms of POV. Like, I just, you know, I see something weird, I want to write about it. Like, that's my thing. And I don't think anyone has ever been like, now people have come up to me and said, oh, you certainly have topics that you enjoy going to and playing with. And I guess that does consider part of my POV. Like, I enjoy making fun of like organized religion or like dumb Christians. Like, dumb Christians is a wheelhouse for me because I'm, mm-hmm. you know, because I grew up as a Christian, so there's a part of me where, like, where I see someone doing it poorly, I'm like, you need to be mocked and run away. Like all those televangelists and stuff that are like asking for money or for a Cessna, you know, that one dude that asked for $65 million for a Cessna for himself. I was you're not a good person.
So
I've never really thought about POV in that terms. And I, interesting that you said that, like, as you began, you didn't want to include your POV, you know, your life experience, all that stuff as much.
I full on thought it was like, it was hack. You know, I thought that was complete hack if you did that. And like, when I would see people do that, I'd be like, that's hack, you know, like that's bullshit, you know, like you're cheating. And it took me a long time to wrap my head around. It's like, you know what? Like, no, it's not cheating. It's just kind of like, it's perspective. And like, you know, I think as a culture, we're just kind of like getting to a point where it's like, we want to see new things, and new things is about people sharing their experiences to people that, you know, I've never heard of that. It's almost discovery, right?
Yeah.
And that's fun, you know, but like, it took me a long time to just be like, oh man, like, you know, I'd see like, you know, Russell Peters, you know, and I'd be like, that's like, I love Russell Peters, but like, as I grew up, like, you know, as I continued, I'm just like, that's, you know, like accent jokes, you know, talking about like, you know, from Brampton being brown. And I'm just like, oh man, like, when are we going to get like a, when are we going to get a white brown comic where he's just going to talk about, you know,
yeah,
you know, just being funny, where he's just funny, you know? And that's, maybe it was that way of kind of being, for me at least, you know, just kind of being like, I thought that's what comedy should be. You know, again, going back to like, I thought it was a meritocracy where it's like, if you're funny, that's where you get the respect. And like, and you know, now we're here. And now I realize that like, it's fresh. It's, people want to see new stuff. People want to engage with other kind of cultures and just kind of like seeing different forms of kind of perspective. And that's like new and exciting, you know, versus like, everyone can just make the same, you know, everyone's got 100 premises on, you know, Trump or televangelists or whatever.
I ask everybody, so I'm curious. And you know, in America, sketch comedy, SNL's the big thing, is the giant. Who would be your favorite SNL cast member of all time?
That's a tough one. Oh man, it's weird. I really like the guys who could play characters, you know. So yeah. Armisen, Hader. You know, but if I had to pick one, and you know, I didn't see a lot of them, but just kind of like when I, you know, I'd see him on a bunch of different things, but it's Phil Hartman, I'd say probably my like go-to.
Yeah, Phil Hartman's awesome. He would be my pick too.
He's just, you know, it's just got so many costumes in his closet, you know what I mean? And he's just versatile, and that's the kind of way I'd like to be, you know, seen on stage. Like, I like playing multiple characters. I like just kind of morphing in and out and being that kind of like guy on stage. And that's, you know, when I write sketches, I try to like do that. Like, I'm very much against being samey, you know? So like, you know, and have you seen his audition video? Like that? Where I was like, oh man.
Where actually, it's John Lovitz actually comes in and helps him with something like,
Yeah,
and I think
it's legendary.
And I think everything that he auditions with eventually gets on the show. Like, I think he does the like the 1940s actor getting fired. I think he does that like within the first month of him being on the show. Like, Farman's fantastic. Yeah. I always ask the Canadians when I talk to them, is there something in Canadian pop culture, whether it's a TV show, a live act, music, whatever, is there something that's like very Canadian that Americans should seek out
in terms of sketch,
any event, anything Canadian that an American should look for that we went out about?
That the first show that I thought made Canadian television like worth it, where I finally gained respect in my eyes. And I'm sure there's a bunch of shows, but for me, it was this show called Slings and Arrows.
Okay. I don't know what that is.
It's about...
Or do I?
It's about It's about a Shakespeare. It's set in a town where they have a Shakespeare festival. And it's about like this guy who used to be this amazing Hamlet, and then he had a nervous breakdown, you know, and then 10 years later, his old, you know, director dies, and then he sees him as a ghost, and he gets brought back in to kind of like remount Shakespeare, to remount Hamlet on stage. And it's just kind of like a comedy, you know, it's a satire about kind of like the theater scene and just kind of like acting and in general. It's very well written. It's I would say it's probably one of my top five shows all time.
Oh, interesting. I'm looking it up, and Mark McKinney from Kids in the Hall was one of the writers.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think he co-developed it. He's also like a main character there too as well.
I'll have to search that out. That sounds interesting.
It's an amazing show. You'll love it.
So then, like, I, you know, as we're wrapping up, as we're finishing off, try to get a little deeper, I suppose. So first off, I mean, you've been doing this for a while. You went through the Second Cities training center, and, you know, which probably was multiple years. So what's a piece of advice that you would give to a new comedy writer? Something that you've learned over your time?
I'll give two pieces of advice, unless it's only one.
Go for it. No, give me everything.
I would say 3 to 4 pages max, because 3 to 4 pages, Times New Roman, 12-point font. Don't try to cheat it, you know, because like you can feel anything over 4 minutes, you can feel that on stage. And in a live comedy setting, it's just, if there's not a lot of action or dynamicness in the sketch, it's going to go bad. It's going to feel boring. You know, it's going to get stuck at points. Now, that my second thing would be structure. So if there's anything, the number one thing I learned from Second City was, you know, the structure. And they have kind of like a five to six point structure, where you have like your platform. That's kind of like where your story is set, your scenario, the tilt, you know, what changes in that world. And then ideally it's kind of like you have 3 beats, like the heightening, you know, where every beat something changes, you know, continues changing in that. And then point of return, that's your highest point, you know, all that. It's so key. I never write a sketch without that. I can tell when I watch a sketch now, where people, sometimes it's people I have dialogue where it's just kind of like, what do you mean? I didn't say that. Yeah, you did. No, I didn't. And that's their like dialogue is the way of kind of like ramping up something. It's just, it's boring. And sometimes like, you get the first laugh, but then it gets samey. And I would say structure.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you on the length thing. I've been telling people that the length of your sketch has to be proportional to the amount of people in the sketch. Because I don't want to see us 2 people do a 5-page dialogue. Like, that feels...
Yeah. Oh. Yeah,
that, you can that feels feel like
every
a lot.
Minute of that. Yeah. And unless there's so many things going on, but then you run the risk of like it just being so wacky that like, you know, the audience is lost anyway in the story, because you have to connect them to the scenario, the story of your material, right?
And I think with structure, I think people forget sometimes that like these sketches theoretically are mini stories. Like we're telling...
Yeah, you're telling like a 3-act story.
In 5 minutes, like, yeah. So there does have to be beginning, middle, end. There has to be, you know, the progression. It can't just linger on one note forever. Like,
yeah. And I think technology is, you know, now that we get so much of our humor in bite-sized pieces like YouTube Shorts, TikToks, and things like that, like the audience language, like, you know, there's that cultural level where it's like, you know, where we want things to be shorter and shorter, like get to the point quicker, you know. And you know, I think people know 90% of the time where the scene's going, you know. So it's like, if you're getting there really slowly and it's like a 5-minute sketch, you know, they're just gonna be sitting there with their arms crossed.
Yeah, you should entirely know who the people are, where you are, like bang right away, like
exactly
first line dialogue. I should know everything. I should know about the basics of what's happening.
Yeah.
Go from there.
When we write a sketch on us, we're like, okay, like three lines of dialogue max, and we already know where the story is, and we already know kind of like who the characters are, and then you can start to change the world, or like, you know, just kind of like, okay, so something changes in one character's world, and now the sketch is actually beginning, you know?
Yeah. And then finally, I mean, it sounds like you've wanted to do this most of your life, so why has comedy been a pursuit of your adulthood? Like, between, you know, taking improv classes to taking sketches to creating this high school sitcom parody to now having your sketch team with Triracial, like, why comedy?
You know, it's nice. I grew up, you know, like I said, my two role models were Jim Carrey and, you know, my brother. And, you know, I found out how many I'm making people to laugh, like, get some to like you. You know, that's a superficial thing about it. It's kind of like, oh, this guy's funny.
It helps. But,
you know, and yeah, in terms of doing comedy, it's just like, it's again, that high, you know, you put on a good show, you get off stage and just like, wow, that was an amazing experience. And, you know, even though I want to be a writer, like, there's something different about just kind of performing as well, where you just knowing you made that audience laugh, and just, it's unbelievable. It's like, I think that euphoria is, I don't know where you get that, you know? So that's equal to an orgasm for me. You know what I mean? And if I can get paid for it, like, that's the perfect, you know, world. That's the perfect, like, you know, thing for me.
I think it's interesting that, as you say, that, like, you know, as the writer performer, like, it's cool to see something that you've written do well on stage, but it is much better when you perform something that you've written and it goes well. Like, there is an extra level to the satisfaction there.
Yeah. Cause like, yeah, if I write something and then I'm also on stage performing and I get that, you know, I know where I'm expecting the laugh, you know, and I get that laugh. It's like, yeah. Yeah. Like, intellectually, I wrote that thing. It hit and it got a laugh. Great. As a performer, I acted something and they were like, that's funny. And then you get that high too. Right.
Yeah. Where, you know, stuff that I've written and other people perform, like, there's part of me that gets in my head of like, oh, they did that weird. They're laughing at him doing that weird instead of how I wrote it. Like, that's like, there's a little bit of grumpiness that I get for that one.
Yeah. But, yeah. And like I said, the writing is definitely kind of like that intellectual part, I think, or, you know, just kind of like that mind part. And then maybe performing is like that body kind of high, you know? Mm. But yeah, comedy is just fun. It's just fun to do. You should not waste your life doing things that aren't fun for you. So if you like comedy, you know, try it out. And then, you know, I would be nowhere if I didn't take a class. Like I mentioned, that writing, that, you know, when we were all kind of coming up together through the training center, sometimes I think back, I'm like, how much people like took like a level one improv class or writing class, and they had a shitty class, and it was like, you know what, like, maybe this ain't it for me, because I'm not having fun, you know? And like, there's probably hundreds of stories like that, and it's tragic in a way. And all I can do is just kind of be grateful that, like, you know, the one sketch writing class I took, it was with like the perfect people, and like, we're all still friends. You know, I met John through that class, and, you know, we've been doing comedy together for about 4 years now.
Yeah.
And hopefully more.
Yeah. Great. Thanks, Viv.
Thanks, Josh. It's great being here.
Viv and the rest of Triracial are heading to Montreal Sketchfest, performing Friday, May 5th, in the 10 p.m. slot at Montreal Improv, along with Sproink and Oink from Montreal and Cheap Wine from Toronto. Tickets and more information are available at montrealsketchfest.com. Triracial will also be performing this summer at Toronto Fringe Festival, July 5th through the 6th. For more information, you can follow Triracial on Instagram at @tri_racial. Viv also co-runs a comedy zine called Egg Mag. That's mag with 2 G's, a humor zine. Follow that on Instagram at Egg Magazine. The magazine has 2 G's. Online canzine takes place from May 5th through the 11th, where you can grab physical and digital copies of Egg Mag. Sketchy Beater, our sketch comedy open mic, live and in person, returns to Tattooed Mobs this Sunday, May 7th, 2 p.m. in the afternoon. All the information, including if you want to sign up beforehand,
is available at sketchybaiter.com. My First Sketch is a Philly Sketch Fest production. You can find out more information at phillysketchfest.com. Follow Philly Sketch Fest on Instagram at Philly Sketch Fest. The music on this episode is by the band No-No, which you can check out at nonoband.bandcamp.com. Like My First Sketch on Facebook, follow the show on Twitter, rate, review, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. This is Josh Hyam. Thanks for listening. Go see some comedy.